Hello, Feely humans. Welcome to another episode of You, Me, Empathy. That's you, that's me, and that's empathy. Hi, my name is Noan Wells. I am the creator of this podcast. I'm also the founder of the Feely Human Collective. And this is episode 244 on Grief to Love with Silky Erwald. Silky and I, in this conversation, explore the subconscious and grief, how grief intersects with empathy, ways that we can feel more connected to those we've lost, and what it means to go from grief to love. Silky is a grief specialist, grief awareness advocate, and just has a ton of profound wisdom in the area of grief and being witness to grief and supporting people through grief. Really, really appreciated this conversation. Obviously, the content warning today on this episode is, because we focus on grief, we talk a lot about death and about those who have died. So fair warning there. We don't get into any gruesome details or anything of that sort, but we do talk about death and grief and dying. So that's the content warning. Before we get to the episode, I do want to share something exciting. If you listened to the last episode, you'll know that the new Feely Human membership community is out. It's live. It is in the world. And I want you to be a part of it. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, if you go to feelyhuman.co/membership, that's feelyhuman.co/membership, you can learn more about what the membership community means. And I'll give you a little brief recap of what it means here. It's a monthly private, it's a private membership community that features monthly events and spaces to talk about things like grief and mental health and the stuff that brings us joy and all sorts of things. There is a free space. There's a free tier to the community where you can, where we talk about the podcast. We talk about our feelings. We talk about, we have weekly highs and lows. And then there's a paid tier, which gets you access to a lot of different events. So weekly events, I host heart to hearts on specific deep dive topics. We have our emotional check-in cohort that kicks off in February, where we meet twice a month and just get deep and feely and vulnerable with one another. The key there is we really learn to listen actively and be present for our big feelings with other feely humans. The other big event, which is monthly, is our Movies That Make Us Feel movie club. And we pick a movie each month, and then we talk about it through the lens of how it made us feel, and it's a blast. And then another big event that we have once a month is called Feely Human Friends, where an expert comes into the space, comes into the community, and leads an event on a topic of their choosing. So as an example, this coming Wednesday, the 25th, my dear friend Kim Erickson, who is the founder of the Canine Republic, she's a dog trainer, we're going to talk about how our emotions affect our animals, our dogs in particular. And I'm really looking forward to that. This should be so much fun. As you know, I'm a dog lover, and I'm an emotion lover. So very excited about that. And then there's a deep dive space on grief, as I mentioned, and a bunch of other things. One-on-one matching is available for the free members and the paid members, but lots of fun stuff, lots of great events every month, lots of great ways to connect with other people and really be witness to the whole of one another. So I hope that you can join. I hope you can check it out, at least learn more about it. Go to feelyhuman.co/membership. And if you join between now and February 11th, you'll be a founding member of the community, for one, and that gets you $5 off per month, the monthly membership. So it's $20 a month for founding memberships, or $200 a year. Then after February 11th, it'll be $25 a month and $250 a year. So keep that in mind, something to think about. If you join now, between now and February 11th, you'll be a founding member and you'll get a little discount. Please check it out. I would love to have you join. Love to see you in there. Again, go to feelyhuman.co/membership. And the link to that will also be in the show notes for this episode at feelyhuman.co. Okay, enough about that. Let's get to the episode. This wonderful episode with the wonderful Feely Human, Silky Erwald, on grief to love. Enjoy. Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective. On this show, we explore the struggles, the triumphs, the brights, and the darks we face as humans trying to be human on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. You, Me, Empathy was created so that we can be witness to our collective humanity through the lens of empathy, vulnerability, and emotional curiosity. We aim to destigmatize mental health, lead fiercely with our hearts, feel our feelings without shame and judgment, and share our courageous stories so that others may feel less alone and more connected as Feely humans. You, Me, Empathy is a brave place designed to inspire the beauty in each of us, because each of us, in all of our kaleidoscopic parts, makes up a magical whole that deserves to be seen. Today, I'm with love in my heart to be here with grief specialist, grief awareness advocate, and creator of the Grief to Love program. It's Silky Erwald. Hello, Silky.
Hello. So lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Non.
So lovely to have you. Let's kick off the show with an emotional check-in. How are you feeling?
I'm actually feeling... That's always such a great question, isn't it? I'm feeling really excited to be here. Also, it has been my dad's 1 year anniversary just a few days ago. So that brought up a lot of emotion again. But I also has, I always love going to the sunrise at the beach. It's kind of like a way how I feel connected with my deceased loved ones. And as I was sat there, I just felt immense gratitude for having had him as my dad. And I just realized how interesting it was, how much my grief had transformed from that incredible raw visceral pain into just a lovely smile on my face now when I think about him, and a warmness in my heart. And that again kind of then created more gratitude for being able to feel this now. So yeah, wow. At the moment I'm feeling grounded and grateful and excited to be on the show.
I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah, and 1 year, it's not that long, and yet maybe it's an eternity to some in some place, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It feels like nowadays, you know, in a pandemic still, right? I say, when is what, right? It feels like time is an illusion sometimes, right? And then we have these markers in life, you know, people pass, people die, right? Birthdays, events, anniversaries. These anniversaries that mark time, that remind us, that maybe bring us back to reality, to center. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's strange, this life, a little bit. I'm grateful to hear that you've had this journey from visceral, raw, to a little bit of gratitude and reflection on this impact that your father had on you. That's beautiful.
Yeah. You know, it's the thing about, and I think why I love going to the beach for sunrise when I really want to feel close to them is also because in the beginning, both when my sister passed away and when my dad died, I was always, in the early stages, I was always shocked by the normality of life. What? What? The bus is still going? Like, people still go to work? How? What? You know, my life had just shattered into a million pieces, mm-hmm. and that the world just kind of kept turning, and other people had no idea, and they were just living their life normally. Of course, they were getting on a bus or a train and going to work. But at the beginning, that was a bit of a shock. It almost felt a little bit disrespectful and stuff like that.
Yes.
But at the same time also then, and it was the same with the sunrise, that I was almost shocked that the sun rose again the next day. Mm. But at the same time, it also gave me an anchor. It gave me this stability, this one thing that I knew was certain. And it gave me that sense of certainty and safety that even though everything else had changed, that was the one dependable thing in my life. So in the early days, I watched the sunrise every single day because it gave me hope. It gave me a sense of connection and it gave me that sense of certainty as well. And I think it's just really important. And it doesn't matter what it is for people that they do, but to have like a little ritual. And of course, also because sunrise takes a while. You know, if you get there early enough to see all the beautiful colors and stuff. And it gave me that 45 minutes of just stillness, of just sitting and being with my thoughts and being with my grief and just sitting and watching the sunrise at the same time and also connecting to the beauty of nature again.
Yeah, you're facing the fact that it will go on. Yeah. This world, nature, it's going to happen every day, this sunrise.
Yes.
Every day it happens without regard for the things that happen in our lives. And in one respect, that does feel harsh.
Yes.
And in another, as you point out, and I think it's both and here, and in another, it's darn right beautiful, right? Because it is that anchor.
Yes.
I'm wondering for you, like in those early days and sitting with that sunrise, like what came up for you? Like as you sat there, you said 45 minutes, that's a long time to sit with those feelings.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, everything came up. Everything came up. Often the endless questions of why or how or if we had done this, especially with my sister, would she still be alive? My sister died of cancer, and so there were all of those relentless questions that no matter how many times you answer them for yourself, they just keep popping up because the unconscious is just very resistant to any form of logic. Because it just feels. But I mean, I think because I have the advantage of I already had worked with grief for many, many, many years before my sister passed away and before my dad passed away. So I had the understanding that the more I could allow myself to just feel whatever without judgment, that would really help. And that in the beginning when my sister passed away, I kind of had this sense of I wanted to get a sign from her or I wanted to feel a sense of connection. And I realized I was just putting all of this pressure on myself that, I was just getting in my own way of anything really. So that was a lovely realization to have as well.
We do that.
We so do that.
Well, and then we also put blame, you know. You said like, what could have we done? You know, we ask the question, you know, we go through that and it's so human to do that, right? Because it is like, you know, it's such a vacillating, amorphous wonder sphere of this, or maybe juxtaposition of this like real meaning making, like, oh, there's so much meaning in this life. And then like, it's just what I said before. And then this like, well, that's random happenstance. Why the hell did that happen? You know, like my sister is gone. Why did that happen? That doesn't seem right.
Yes.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you question.
Yeah.
Of course you question.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard.
And I think as human beings, as the mammal that we are, our brain is just designed to fix things, to solve problems. That's how we evolved as humanity, is that somebody got fed up with something and decided to solve that problem and then invented a solution for it. So it's what our brains are designed to do. So, of course, then we also want to fix the unfixable.
Yeah. So you mentioned, Silky, that, you know, obviously you experienced this loss of your sister, your father, in close succession of each other. And then prior to that, you said you had experience with grief that preceded that, you know, preceded that well in advance of that. Like what experience was that?
So that's in a professional capacity. So okay. I'm traditionally a hypnotherapist and master practitioner of neuro-linguistic programming. And so I work with anxiety, trauma, and also with grief.
Gotcha.
But I also run a general hypnotherapy clinic and have done so for, what is it now, 13 or 14 years. And about 12, 13 years ago, I had a lady come in and she wanted help with drinking less. And I asked her what the problem was, and she said, well, I'm okay during the day. I come home at night and then I always drink two bottles of wine and then I go to bed and I do the same thing the next day. And I asked her, since when has this been a problem? And she could tell me exactly. She said 2 years, 6 months, and 17 days, or whatever the number was, but it was around the 2.5 year mark. And I just said, what happened? And she said, my husband died. And that moment I realized this poor woman did not have a problem with alcohol. She had a problem with grief. So I got permission from her and said, how about we do some grief work around this? And then we started working with all the grief things, and she just kind of felt like he was so far away from her. And there was no connection, and all the memories she had, she said, I don't have any spontaneous memories. And if I do, they're just like a photograph, but I don't feel connected to him. And sometimes I need to remind myself of the things that we did by actually looking at a photo. But when I do, then it just makes me sad because I just feel that we'd never be able to do this again.
Yeah.
And so then through the work that we did, she then all of a sudden said, now she has spontaneous memories. She might be driving past somewhere and then she sees something and it reminds her of what they did 17 years ago, or that holiday, or where they had this coffee, or that all of a sudden she said, my memories of him are so much richer. They're so much more vivid and they are completely spontaneous now. And she said, I hardly remember him now in his final days where he was just that frail human being, but I remember him now of the entirety that we spent together. I get memories of him as a young man when we first met. I remember him later on. I remember him as the dad of the kids and all of these. So now she had this much richer experience. And she said, and now I feel like he's in my heart all the time. So, and then of course she stopped drinking. We didn't even need to do anything on the alcohol. That just fell away automatically. Because she said, I just feel empty. I just feel like a huge part of me is missing. And once we had reintegrated all of those things that she shared and she felt really close to him, she didn't need the alcohol anymore.
Wow.
So, and I experience that a lot with people, whether it'll be overeating or, you know, whatever we do to numb the pain, really.
So was that 13 years ago, was that like one of the first experiences where you had that, when you're dealing with that type of grief?
Yeah, that was my first ever grief client. Mm-hmm. And it really sparked a huge interest on how subconscious processes work with grief. And then I went deeper into studying how hypnotherapy and grief can work together. And started to really specialize in that field. And then I saw more bereaved clients. First, purely in person in my clinic, and then more and more online, online as well, worldwide. So, and that's how I developed all of this understanding about grief. But then when my sister died 4 years ago, even though we saw it coming, but because she just loved life, she was always so positive, and no matter what was thrown at her, she was always, yeah, we're going to get through that, sure, da, da, da. And because she defied death so many times, that when it actually happened, everybody was really shocked, even though we should have seen it coming, really. There was, in hindsight, there was no denying the fact, but I think we just kind of refused to. And so when it then happened and I was going through it, I got a much deeper understanding for my bereaved clients. And I thought, so this is what that feels like when they say you're on your knees on the bathroom floor and you just can't get. I said, I knew it was horrible, but I didn't know it was that horrible. So it was also very fascinating for me because I was grieving, and at the same time, ever so often, I would almost float out of myself and observe and go, ooh, okay, got to make a mental note of that.
Yeah.
So I've taken all of those experiences then and also wrapped them into, I think, probably an even deeper understanding.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Improved the grief to love program from that again.
So. I do want to explore that in depth, the grief to love piece of it, but something came to me, and I want to ask this of myself too, but I want to ask you this, Silky. Why help others through this? Why help others through grief? Why do you help others through grief?
It's probably really selfish, because when I can see that sense of relief in my client. Wow. Wow. When they come in and they're really tense and there's that sense of relief. It is just the most, for me, it is the most beautiful gift we can give another human being, is to help them experience relief. I was working with a client recently, and she had lost her mum 20 years ago, and she said, I hardly have any memories of her. And at the end of the session, she sat there and the tears were streaming down her face as a smile came through, and she said, oh yeah, we did this and we did that. Oh, I remember how I took her here. And all of those memories kept flooding back to her. And yeah, that relief. And of course, also, why do I do it? Because I think, yes, the relief piece is huge. Mm-hmm. Also, I learn so much from every single one of my clients. I find that the more aware of grief and with it death I am, the closer it connects me to life.
What do you mean by that?
As human beings, we are so good at rationalizing things away, of not paying attention, not looking at certain things. And everybody will say, oh, yeah, I know I'll die, but let me just get on with this. And we get so busy in life. and we forget to live. And by having that daily reminder, I'm working with a bereaved client, that means somebody who's very important to them has died and they are not here anymore, is also a reminder of my own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And being constantly reminded of my own mortality, I think sometimes lets me evaluate decisions differently.
Mm-hmm. Like, what would be an example of a decision? So, like, if I would extrapolate, you know, if I would take that and maybe apply it, you know, maybe the classic sort of takeaway from that could be potentially, I am reassessing my life in a way that where I am, you know, maybe I am looking at, I'm self-reflective more. I'm like thinking of ways, you know, I'm thinking about my passions more. I'm thinking about what brings meaning to my life. Like, what is that about? Like, what, who am I as a person? And maybe I'm a little bit less frivolous. Maybe I'm a little bit less like focused on the stuff that, in my perspective, doesn't really matter in the end. You know, maybe I'm focused on the people, right? You know, yes. That's how I might take it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you really got it. It's, for me, it connects me more to meaning and purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that is for that particular person.
Yeah.
That, you know, again, for me, there's absolutely no judgment. And for me, it is about connecting with people, connecting with nature, and living my purpose, doing things that make me feel fulfilled.
Hmm.
And that actually is my work. I feel really connected and aligned and fulfilled when I get to do what I do.
That's great. That's so hard to find.
Yeah, I'm very, very blessed. I'm very grateful.
Have you always been sort of called to be like in a position of like a helper, you know, helping people? Were you that way as a kid, as a teenager?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a kid, I was always looking out for the other kids, for the less fortunate kids. Mm. I was always, I think I dragged home, I don't know how many beetles that got hurt in the street, you know, like little insects
sure.
that I needed to fix. And my mum was like, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was always drawn towards rescuing animals and people.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't always worked in my favor, obviously. But of course, I've learned from that as well. And then, but later on, I didn't go into being a therapist straight away. I did the corporate world first and, you know, did the corporate career thing and just realized that I was just desperately unhappy. And I was earning good money and all of that, but I was just not happy at all.
How did you come to that conclusion? And what was there, like a moment, rock bottom moment? Was there just like a, what was that calling quits moment like?
I think it was more of a jigsaw. That started to come together.
Love that.
And because then I've got the next job at a bigger company with a bigger position and a bigger company car. And I just realized that I got even more unhappy and that my sleep was even worse. And that I try to fill it with bigger parties, and that clearly didn't work. And then there was a takeover of that company, and I had a nightmare that everybody was getting a redundancy payment and being made redundant, but me. So that my nightmare was that they decided to keep me. And I kind of thought, that's interesting.
The one employee they decided to keep, Silky.
So, yes. And luckily, that didn't happen. And I was made redundant and I got some payout and decided, no, I was not going to go for the next job in the corporate world. I was going to take some time out and come back to my senses.
And this was 13, 14 years ago?
Oh, that was 17, 18 years ago. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, it was good. It was good. And I just took some time out, went traveling for a bit. That's also how I landed in Australia. So that was fantastic.
Where were you before?
In Germany.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Is that where you're originally from?
Well, I'm originally from Germany, but I grew up in Japan. So, okay. As a child, until I was 15, I was in Japan.
Okay. All right. Why Japan?
Because my dad was an engineer and I had a big project there and... Yeah, he got asked whether he would like to go for a year or two as a young engineer and turned out to be a lot longer than 1 or 2 years. That was fine with everybody. So, yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. How do you feel like now that you've been working in the space that you've been working now for, the past 13, 14 years, you're not obviously in the corporate world anymore. Do you feel like... you're in separate worlds, like that world is over here. Does it feel like a world that you're in opposition to, or you're working to maybe try to heal, or like, how does that feel now? Like when you look at the corporate world now and like the machine of capitalism and all of that hustle and bustle, like how does it feel now to you when you look at it?
I think it's a fantastic question. It feels very much like I've left it behind.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it doesn't feel separated.
Mm.
So I know that it is part of me. I have learned so much from having been through it. It gives me a much deeper understanding of the struggles that my clients go through. And I wouldn't want to go back there ever. Definitely not. It just feels like it was a really long time ago. I was a very different person then. And maybe I needed it to evolve to where I am today.
Mm-hmm. That's important. That's very empathetic.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that we can, as humans, change in big, meaningful ways.
Yes.
So important.
Yeah.
Like it feels, it's scary and it's so essential, right?
Yeah, it's so, so essential. And, I think there was actually a time for a very long time I didn't have that empathy with myself.
Mm.
Definitely not while I was in the corporate world. And then also for a long time after when I started doing the work that I do now, that I always looked back and I thought about that younger me as like a lost soul or somebody who had come off the right path or a bit of a loser or whatever. And then I eventually managed to change my perspective, and now I realize that that younger me actually was a legend, was a bit of a hero to have gone through all of that, to have been brave enough to make those changes, to be courageous enough to do this, that, and the other, to have failed at this, that, and the other, and to still have come out the other end. So now I'm actually very grateful to my younger self and think, yeah, you did a pretty good job. You know, it was tough and you got through and here we are. So yeah, thanks. It was good.
I love that. That is very empathetic. It's important.
Yeah.
We need to do that. Yeah. I mean, there's no timeline.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about empathy as it sort of intersects with grief.
Yes.
I think you had said, if I'm recalling correctly, something in your original email to me, Silky, around this idea around empathy for those in bereavement, empathy for those who are grieving, right? And how, and I've seen this myself, how we lose patience for those who are in grief, right?
Yeah.
And it feels, I mean, it frankly feels very harsh. It feels callous and unfair to put that on anyone, like there's any timeline for such a heinous experience. But talk to me a little bit about that piece of it and how you talk about that piece, the empathy and the grief experience.
So people, in my experience, grief, their suffering, their grief needs to be witnessed.
Mm.
So it is really important that we acknowledge it. And there is so much in language that we can do, because it comes also back to that as human beings, we have been trained that to be a good friend, we need to make sure that our friends are okay. We don't let our friends be unwell. So we do something to fix it,
mm-hmm.
because that's what we have been trained to do. But we can't fix this, because anything short of bringing their loved one back is not going to make them feel better. And a lot of our grief illiteracy comes from the idea of wanting to say something that will make them feel better. But once we get completely rid of that idea and just accept there's absolutely nothing in early grief, there's absolutely nothing that anybody could say or do that'll make them feel better. The best we can hope for is to not make them feel worse.
Mm.
And when we try to make things better, we say things along the lines of, yes, but at least. No, that nothing good was ever said after at least.
Don't even say but.
Exactly. Yeah, both of those. Don't. Nothing good comes after that, ever. And once we get rid of the idea that we could make that person feel better, then it's much easier to just be with them. Mm. And of course, being with somebody who is in visceral pain and in that utter bereavement is not easy. It's uncomfortable. And still we need to do it, to just be there, to just have that space, provide that space, and just go, I'm here. I'm here. If you want to talk about it, that's fine. I'm here. If you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. I'm here. I'll just sit with you. Let me go make a cup of tea for you. And that is so important. Yeah. And also, again, not I'm going to make a cup of tea for you because it'll make you feel better. No. I honestly, and also to say something along the lines as in, I actually don't know what to do. I don't know how to support you. And I just want to be here. I can do this, I can do that, I can do that, or I can just sit with you. And that is so, so important. And then it is that witnessing, giving the space for the grieving person,
yeah,
that is so important. That is so helpful. Mm. And of course, I find that our society is just moving faster and faster and faster. And, you know, and of course, other people need to get on with their lives. The world keeps turning. And at the same time, you can still check in with your bereaved friend. And it doesn't have to be anything big. It can just be a short message. Hey, I'm thinking of you. Or it could be, hey, I saw this today and it made me think of your person. So because the person dies the first time when they die, and then they die again when nobody speaks about them anymore.
Mm.
So people often think, oh, I don't want to bring it up. It'll just remind them. It'll rip the Band-Aid off. It'll make it worse. No, they're thinking about their deceased loved one all day, every day anyway.
Yeah.
So what we actually do is when we mention their name, when we remember something, share a memory, it actually makes the bereaved person feel like, oh, I'm not the only one who's missing them. Yes, they did make an impact on somebody else as well. And it yes. keeps the memory alive.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and, you know, for the listeners, Silky and I were talking before we got even recording about this skill that I feel we all need to learn in sitting still and being witness to each other. We all are going to have to do that at some point. We're all going to be the one who is lost and be the one who has to sit still with another person. You know, we're all going to change, swap roles there. So, you know, practice, you know, it doesn't need to even be like in this real life scenario, just practice with someone. It could be like practicing sitting still with someone, sitting still with a friend, listening, learning, reflecting. Like, this is empathy at work. It's crucial. And then when these big life moments happen, we will be able to be there.
Yeah.
Not to change, not to fix, but to be there.
Yeah.
In love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about, you know, obviously we are still, you know, like just in LA County, like COVID cases are rising again.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still like living in a time where over 1 million people have died, right? We're dealing with collective grief on a level that is unprecedented, right? You know, Black and brown people continue to be murdered and shot by police officers. Like, how do you talk about that? I mean, maybe this is not your specialty, but like, how do you, as someone who talks about grief and thinks about grief and feels about grief, feels that in your own life, the collective grief piece, the stuff you know, Uvalde, Texas, right? Kids being shot, yeah. Right? Like horrifying things happening in the world and feeling, oh, there's nothing I can do about it. That's not true, right? Like, how can I be useful in my grief? Like, maybe there's something there. Like, how do you feel about that? Like, what goes on in your heart when that stuff comes up, when it comes to grief?
I always think about it as in each of these people have mothers, fathers, siblings, friends, aunties, uncles. Yeah, I just think about the massive ripple effect because what we hear in the news is just the number. This many people have died in this. This many children have died. But we need to think about this. Each and every single one of these people come with I don't know, somewhere between, you know, 10 and 37 other people who are impacted. Yeah, they're part of a community. Mm-hmm. I think also if, I don't know, but maybe if we actually looked at how many relatives, how many people are impacted by each and every single one of those deaths, and we publish those figures as well.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll have a bigger impact. Maybe people would then kind of get how important it is to take action now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I just feel, you know, it's, you know, obviously there's so much at stake. And it's blood boiling when I think about stuff like Uvalde, and you know, stuff in the world, and it arrests me to stillness at times, and it makes me wanna just stop. But you know, I say this a million times on the show, listeners, don't stop. You know, turn that grief into anger, into activism, because you have a voice, you always will, and keep fighting, because it's important. Use that heart, use that big heart of yours. It's a leader, it's a natural leader.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I think also we got to pay attention to the signals that we get from our unconscious.
Mm.
And that anger, that lets you know something.
Mm-hmm.
That lets you know that something is not right.
Sure.
And it also lets you know that you do have the power to change.
Yeah.
So we've got to pay attention, because again, as we said earlier, it's, you know, brings you closer to meaning and living a meaningful life. And the more we listen to the messages that we get from whatever you want to call it, our gut feeling, the better that is.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about life after death? Is there a life after death in your perspective?
You know, it's such a, I mean, nobody knows, right?
Nobody knows.
And here's what I've chosen to do is, I have chosen to believe in that there is some form of something after death.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because it makes me feel good now.
Mm.
It gives me hope now.
Hope. And
yeah, it gives me hope. I'm at this moment in time, I choose to believe that when I die, those who have gone before me will be there to, I don't know, come and guide my soul to wherever they're going to guide me, mm-hmm. right? And that just kind of makes me feel good now. And mm-hmm. it takes away the fear of death, because I know they're going to be there. And, well, when I die and it turns out to be the great spiritual hoax, well, I won't really particularly care about it, because then I'm dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, it's just like, well, it works now. And once I'm dead and it turns out there's nothing there, well,
yeah,
nothing lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. That's interesting. I have no attachments to it, really. I don't fear death. I don't really think about it. Jessica would say I'm a bit cavalier with my life. Sometimes I think that's maybe the depression. Sometimes I think it's also just my trying to lean into the joy too, you know, trying to kind of do things that bring me joy also, you know, a bit, and not worry too much. So yeah, I don't attach myself too much to it. And that is, so far that has worked for me.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly helps, I think, with the being present bit, you know, trying to be present bit, you know, It's always a trine. It's always a trine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So grief to love. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the framework. Like what does grief to love mean?
So the way I came up with a name is that in the beginning, there is just that visceral pain, that brutal grief.
Yeah.
And that in actual fact, it's that love that hasn't got anywhere to connect to anymore. And that's why we feel so lost, so uncertain. And then when we go through that incredibly messy grieving process, and at the beginning, we don't even want to stop grieving because the grief is the last thing that still connects us to our loved one.
Yeah.
So I've worked with so many people and they say, well, if I'm completely honest, a part of me doesn't want to stop grieving.
Makes sense.
They might be a few months or years down the track. And somebody said to me the other day, I almost miss the early days of grief because I still felt so close to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now there's more distance that has been created. So then they're almost grieving for the loss of that intense grief. And and then they feel disloyal. You know, they might all of a sudden have heard themselves laughing for the first time again. And they go, oh, how dare I?
They feel guilty.
Oh my God, how dare I?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. There's an instant guilt piece in it. And so then through the framework that I have built is because I think a lot of traditional grief work works with the logic. Goes, yes, yes, yes. But, you know, logically, you know, he would want you to be happy and da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, they kind of get that.
Mm-hmm.
But as I always say in grief, your head is fine. Your logic is fine. It's your heart that's broken and not your head. So we actually need to work with the heart piece. We need to work with the emotions. And the best way that I have found is to work with the subconscious processes. That little voice on the inside of your head, that kind of goes when somebody gives you well-meaning advice. And on the outside, you're saying, oh, yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, I'll give that a try. And on the inside, that voice goes, hell no. No, I'm not doing that. That's the unconscious processes.
Yeah.
And instead of trying to fight against the subconscious processes, we actually work with them. We work with those processes. We really pay attention to all of those subconscious objections. And once we start doing that, so I was working with somebody online the other day, and her daughter had passed away, and she said, it feels like I don't really want to let go of the grief. And I said, okay, good. Let's pay attention to that part of you that still wants to be experiencing the grief. What's the intention? What does this part want? Oh, it makes me feel connected to her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Good. So then if we could find a way that would work at least as well as the intense grief, or maybe even better than that, to feel that sense of connection, would you be willing to give that a go? And then what we needed to do was to find a way that would work at least as well as, or even better than, the grief to feel that sense of connection. And she had that realization that if she could have lots of spontaneous memories, and that when she would say her daughter's name, she would get a warm feeling.
Mm.
She was like, oh, yeah, that would work better. And so the grief to love process really is designed to take it more from just painful and bitter to bittersweet, so that we can integrate so that the deceased loved one still has a part in their life, that they still get spoken about, that they're, you know, that you'd even say, oh man, he would have loved that, you know, and it's okay. Yeah. And that the person, when a sad memory comes up, yes, they still tear up.
Of course.
And then it's gone. Yeah. It's just kind of like, it goes for a moment and then they can get on with life because they still have that connection. So it's death ends a life, but it doesn't end the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that we still have a sense of ongoing connection and that we allow I think we always want to go back to how things were, but we can't. We need to allow the loss and the grief to change us, to form us, and then to also integrate everything that we've shared with the person and let that form us into a newer version of ourselves, where the loss and the grief and all the wonderful influences and all the things that we shared with that person become part of us. And so that we can continue living in a way that, you know, would make them proud, but also in a way that works for us now and where we still have a loving connection, but that doesn't prevent us from living life.
Mm-hmm.
And because to me, it's always a tragedy that one life has been lost. That is incredibly sad. Now, if we lose a second life to the grief, or to alcohol, or anxiety, or depression, or whatever else,
mm-hmm.
that is a real tragedy.
Yeah.
And I see my role in this very much in helping people integrate, work with their unconscious processes, not against them, get the logical bits out of the way, and find a solution that works for every individual. Let them find their own solutions. I always say I don't really have any answers. I never tell people what they should be doing. I don't know. All I have is some very good questions and lots of really good processes that are very gentle and that help the person do it in their own way. And the way the program runs is that I do work with people individually online, and I also have a grief to love group coaching program, which is also online. But what it does, and people are different. Some people, they do want to share and they want to go through this experience in a group and have other people to chat to in between the sessions with me, and other people, they just want to do it by themselves.
Yeah.
And that's you know, whatever works.
Yeah.
And also in the group coaching, I also offer then a couple of individual sessions, because some things we just kind of need to work one-on-one.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you for sharing.
It's I love it. And you know, I really feel that my work has gotten so much deeper through my own losses. And I actually, after my dad had died, because I'm in Australia, the whole country was in lockdown. Nobody was allowed to come or go. And so I had to apply, because my dad just died incredibly suddenly. I'd spoken to him on the phone 24 hours earlier, and we were laughing and chatting and da da da.
Wow.
And I had to apply for travel exemption, and luckily I was granted that. But what that meant was that on my return, I had to do hotel quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually set in a hotel room, and you're not allowed, they give you the key and say, this key works exactly once.
Wow.
And
that's
then
intense.
So they lock the room behind you, and then three times a day they ring a bell. And then that means that the food has been delivered outside your door, and you're allowed to open the door and grab your food, and that's that. So I was in there for 2 weeks, and that was a massive starting point for me to really go back into my program and go, what do I need to tweak? What do I need to change? How yeah. can I improve this? What can I make better? Because I had 2 weeks of a lot of stillness.
Just sitting with it.
Just sitting with it. Had nowhere yeah. to go. Had not a lot of distractions. And yeah. I thought, okay, I'm going to utilize this time. And then at the same time, I needed help as well. Mm. And a friend of mine is a very skilled therapist as well. And she said, look, I'd love to help you, but I don't know that much about grief. Mm-hmm. Teach me. So I started to teach her the processes. And from that, of course, I refined them again. And then she said, you need to teach other therapists. So now that is the third thing that I do, is that I teach other therapists how to help their bereaved clients better.
It's beautiful.
So, you know, again,
helping the helpers.
I don't think that this would have happened if I hadn't been stuck in hotel quarantine for 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it takes those hard moments, right? Yeah. And you were, yeah, like you said, you were able to deepen you had a measurable amount of empathy, and you were able to deepen that because of those experiences, you know, very hard and tragic. And because of that, you're giving brighter, beautiful lives to these other people who are experiencing grief, which is wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you yeah. for saying that. That's yeah. really beautiful. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's what all humans need to be doing. I mean, I think that is it.
Yes.
We live, we learn, we help others.
Yeah.
Here's hey, friend, this is a thing I learned. You could take it or leave it. That's fine. But this is the thing I learned, because I went through this thing and it was hard. This helped me. May help you. May not.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it. That very much is it. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just sharing. Sharing and loving. Open-hearted. Yeah.
Yes. So true. So true. So true.
Yeah, because why like safeguard our hearts and safeguard the stuff that we glean in these hard moments that are so human, so universally human, such as death and grief, yeah. right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Honestly, it is, as you said, universally human. It's mm-hmm. part of our shared humanity.
Yep.
Okay. And
one of the most.
Yes. We tried to push
taxes,
it away.
Right?
Yeah. Preferably yeah. not in that order.
Preferably not in that order. Let's, yeah. Oh, gosh. Taxes, the worst.
Honestly.
Give me death before giving me taxes. Yeah.
So, but from all of that experience, and also from the experience of having worked with hundreds or thousands of bereaved clients, I've created some kind of grief roadmap that, and of course, it is not a linear process at all. And it was quite funny when I worked with a graphic designer on that, and I said, look, I pretty much need about 5,786 different little roads that go from here to there, and that loop, and that intersect, and that go round and round, and they end in a maze. And she's like, yeah, I can't do that. It's not going to look good.
You are out of your mind, Silky.
Correct. So we kind of came up with a good compromise.
Yeah.
But it really is that roadmap that goes, okay, yes, you kind of go here, then this happens. There's a next thing that's going to happen. There's a next thing that you didn't expect. Mm-hmm. But just be aware, it's going to happen. Your circle of friends is going to change. Some people are just not going to get it. Be aware of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are all those little nuggets on it that give people, that prepare people.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they've kind of gone through it, they go, okay, I know where I am right now. That doesn't mean that in 5 minutes' time, I'll be right at the beginning again. Or that I'll be a lot further ahead, and in 10 minutes, I'll be right at the beginning again. But then, because so many people come to me and they say, I feel like I'm going crazy. I feel like I'm mad. I feel like I'm grieving wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've heard about, I don't know, the five stages of grief. No, sorry. There is a hell of a lot more than that.
Sure.
And they think that they're doing something wrong. And just to give them that, and they go, oh, right, okay, good. I'm not doing it wrong. It's already a relief. And it's a very useful tool.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're there for them.
Thank you, Tom.
The listeners, yes, lean on Silky. And also, don't consult Google, consult your heart.
Yes.
Your heart knows better. Don't, you know, like, the Google will shame you. There's no shame in this process. Your heart knows better.
Yes.
Remember that.
Quote of the day, Non. Quote of the day.
Well, let's talk about empathy heroes, Silky. Mm-hmm. This is the part of the show where my guest, Silky, and I mention someone in our lives, a character from a story or a movie, someone who is deeply empathetic. I will go first to give you a moment to reflect on your empathy hero this week. My empathy heroes this week are, so just yesterday, as of this recording, I drove up to Big Bear, just about a 2-hour drive, and I led an empathy workshop for at this camp called Brave Trails, this organization called Brave Trails Camp. And it's a queer leadership youth camp. And there was about, I don't know, 15 kids, you know, ranging from like 12 to 20. And it was really special. And it was what was really profound about it. There's a number of things, but one of the main things is it just reminded me of hope, of the hope I have for the future of our humanity. These kids that are so brave and vulnerable and empathetic and compassionate about themselves and the earth and each other. It's really something special. You know, just in reflecting on who I was at 13, you know, I was pounding, you know, bottles of warm Chardonnay, like by myself after school, like worlds of difference. So I'm just so grateful that I was able to be a part of that. So shout out to Jessica Weisbuck, one of the co-founders of Brave Trails. And shout out to all the campers. You are all so beautiful and empathetic, and I cherish all of your hearts. So you're my empathy heroes this week.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds fat. It just made me want to go there.
Yeah, it's something special. Yeah, check them out. I think it's bravetrails.org.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I was just so listening to your story that I didn't use the time to reflect.
Good. That's what we want.
But when you first asked the question, what instantly popped into my head is my old dog, who also passed away last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She was my empathy hero. She was my therapy dog. She adopted me when I moved into this neighborhood. She kept showing up on my doorstep, and eventually the neighbors said, well, I think she needs to live with you. And so that's how I found her, or she found me. And I just started taking her to the clinic with me. And she was amazing. She would be either sleeping just in, she was also border collie, but I think she was just born in the wrong body. She probably should have been a Labrador couch potato or something. And
Labrador, as I call them. Labradors. Yeah.
And so I work in a multimodality clinic with psychologists and other modalities, and they all learn to trust her. All of a sudden, she would just follow one of their patients and just barge her way into their room. And then she would just be over there sleeping in a corner. And all of a sudden, she'd get up, walk over to the patient, and sit right next to them.
Mm.
And a few seconds later, they would get emotional and the tears would come out and she was there ready for them to just pet her.
Wow.
And yeah, she just did that with every single one of the practitioners. And she would pick the people in the waiting room that they were the most anxious or whatever was going on with them. And she would just sit there. She wouldn't touch them. She would just sit there. And if they were ready and wanted to pet her, yeah, she was there for them. And so many times she would just stay in the waiting room and just sleep or sleep under the receptionist's desk. And when she'd get up and decide she wanted to be in that room, everybody knew to trust her. She was team mascot. She was just amazing. So she just knew. And when I quite often check myself in for a session and do get some help from a hypnotherapist that I know very well. And it was so funny that she would get up and all of a sudden she'd come to me and I'd go, "Hey, what's going to happen next?" So,
what was her name?
She's Pippi.
Pippi.
Pippi. Mm. Yeah.
Well, Pippi sounds very special and the world will miss her, all of us. Yeah. Yeah, we lost our Scooby last year. He's been gone just over a year and wasn't a therapy dog, but he was a Labrador, black lab, and just he was 13 when he passed and just one of those dogs that just went, always at your feet, went with you everywhere, so loving, so sweet. And that was really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really special. Hard. And I think, because dogs are so in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They're just so present.
Mm-hmm.
They are so, those all these things that we've just been talking about for the last hour or so.
They're really good at it.
They're really good at it. And I think they sometimes look at us and kind of go, "What are you doing?"
I know. I think I always say on the show, and I've said on the show a number of times, dogs remind me to be a bit better human.
Mm.
They remind me to be more present. You know, they remind me to check in on my anxiety. They humble me, they're the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I also help a lot of people whose animals have passed away.
Mm, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's important.
Yeah.
It's so important. And again, it's one of those things, unless people have an animal, they don't necessarily get it.
Yep.
They go, it was just a family member.
Yeah. Yeah. Family member. Absolutely. Well, Silky, this has been lovely. Thank you for being a part of Yumi Empathy.
Thank you so much for having me, Non.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Where can the listeners connect with you and learn more about the lovely work you're doing in the world?
At grieftolove.com. Just
simple.
Grieftolove.com. Very simple.
Perfect. Yeah. I love it. I love it.
Thank you. And that's also where people can download the roadmap and find more information
Amazing.
About grief.
Amazing. Grieftolove.com. You hear that, listeners? That will be at the link in the show notes at feelyhuman.co, grieftolove.com. Silky, thank you. This was lovely. And I'm going to say goodbye to the listeners now, as I always do, this way. And I don't know why I'm doing this preamble, but I'm going to do it. Anyway, I'm here. You're here. We're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring pale blue dot. We have each other. It's Yumi Empathy.